thank you all for having such low standards. You know, nothing confuses an Irishman quite like the game of basketball. You see, most things we're good at involve the ground, like growing potatoes or falling off a bar stool. But thankfully, being a host of a show like mine, from time to time I get the opportunity for people to explain to me the things I can't understand by my personal self. As was the case when I sat down with hoop icon Doug Collins to discuss the intricacies of his game and ours. And believe it or not, Coach flashed me. You'll see, just watch.
Doug, usually the people that I interview play golf. It's one of the reasons they come on the show, but you don't anymore. Why is that?
I wish I did. I've had some physical limitations, David. I have an artificial left knee and two artificial hips.
So there's only one real part of you below the waist?
Exactly. And and I think you know the physical, you know, things that go with playing the game.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, it's like I know that if you're going to play well, you've got to go practice. And it was hard for me to do that. And I'm from a golfing family now. My family loves golf. My son, Chris, he loves the game and is a single-digit handicapper. And, you know, my sister-in-law plays. My grandchildren all play. And I'll get back to playing again once my grandkids get a little older. I might not be very good, but I caddy for them now. So I'm on the course a lot.
When you started playing when you were an assistant coach in Arizona, right?
I did. I actually had three really good buddies out there, and they were all scratch golfers. And so, you know, it was very humbling for me to go out and, you know, hope to break 100 and those guys be shooting, you know, 69, 70, 71. But you know what I really learned from them is I learned how to play. You know, I learned, you know, they taught me how to grip the club, the stance and alignment. If I got myself in the right spot, that I could probably hit a good shot. And I really had fun. It was one of the most fun times of my life going out and learning how to. And it's so addicting. I mean, it's like, yeah. I couldn't get enough of it.
You're a real fan, I know, of the pro game. What's your impression of the youngsters we have at the top at the moment?
How mature they are. You know, I think back, I watched Jordan Spieth, and I think about when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, I was a, you know, sophomore in college, and what my life was like and how it was this little spot in Illinois State University. And to see not only how great they are, David, but their grace under pressure, their ability to do things when the stakes are at the highest. But the one thing I've learned, I think, because of being around greatness is that they never fear consequence. And these young kids are fearless. Man, they get up and they play and they hit shots. And I just so admire that and how much fun they're having doing it. That's what I love.
And Jordan always uses the word we. You know, we, you know, did this, we did that. But when he makes a mistake, it's I.
You know what? I think what he does, he empowers his caddy. The greatest power you can give someone is to make sure that their voice matters. At the end of the day, I've got to make the decision, but I want you to help me. We're out here together. I mean, to me, golf is a very lonely sport. And if you don't have somebody to share the good and the bad with, I think it would be awfully tough. And, you know, it's a little bit like coaching. When things don't go well, as a coach, you take it on your shoulders. And when things go well, you have to talk about how well the players played. I said, you know, it's the players get the win, the coaches gets the loss. I mean, that's sort of how it is.
Well, there's a lot of people would say that you haven't got nearly what you deserved as a player or perhaps as a coach as well.
Well, I've had my heart broken. I have. You know, I mean, 1972, you know, I make two free throws with 3 seconds to go. Should have been a gold medal. They put more time back on the clock, we lose. And so I don't have a gold medal.
Take me through the last 3 seconds of that gold medal game.
We were down one. The Russians did not have to shoot.
Now, were the Russians a basketball powerhouse at this?
They were very unorthodox, you know, so they had a very different kind of game. You know, it was not what we're used to playing. You know, Coach Iba got a lot of criticism because we didn't play an up-tempo game. And he was very much, we're going to build our team with defense. If we can build with defense, that's how we can come together the quickest. And I'll never forget this, David. Before we started the first practice, he wrote the number 50 up on the board, 50. And he said, we're going to play the Russians in the gold medal game, and they're not going to score 50 points against us. So 10 seconds to go in the game, we're losing 49-48. They're sort of milking the clock. They take a shot, and for some reason, it gets blocked and it goes over into the corner. So he tried to make the pass. And so I deflected it, ran it down, and now I'm going to beeline for the basket to win the game and win the gold medal. As I picked up my dribble, the guy from the Russians just clipped my legs out from underneath me. He just flipped me. And so I got the shot up there, hit the floor. My head slid underneath the basket, knocked myself out. I was unconscious. I'm trying to get myself together. And the two assistant coaches, Johnny Bach and Coach Haskins, said to Coach Iba, "We got to get somebody in here to shoot these free throws." And Coach Iba looked at them. He said, "If Doug can walk, he's shooting them." I mean, I got goosebumps hearing
it. So have I.
You know, I mean, just you can imagine. No, David, you're Ryder Cup. You're standing over a putt. The guy said, "We want David Faraday to take that putt."
Oh, I would squeal and run away.
But what I'm saying is, though, you know what that, how that empowers you. Like, that's who we want out there. So walked to the line, made my first one, made the second one. We went up 50 to 49. Okay, 3 seconds to go. They threw the ball in. The guy that I was guarding took about two dribbles. Horn sounded. They stopped the game. And so we couldn't. Why? Why'd they stop the game? Well, it was right in front of the Russians bench. They were jumping around. They were trying to get a timeout. They couldn't get a timeout. So they gave them the ball back with 1 second, threw it in. We intercepted. We won the gold medal. All of a sudden, we're all pulled together and said, "No, they're going to put 3 more seconds back on the clock, and we're going to do it again." The guy throws a pass, steps over the line, throwing the ball in. Alexander Belov caught the ball, laid it in, and we lost. Final score was 51 to 50.
You never picked up the medal?
So we protested the game. The protest was heard the next morning, so we were up all night, just walking around Munich, and there was like 6 or 8 of us just hanging out or whatever. We heard the decision came back. We were voted down. I think it was 4-3 or 5-4, and it was 5 Iron Curtain to 4 Free World. So it was a political vote, as said. We were in the Cold War, and so we all got together and we said it wasn't like anything. We just said, you know, we don't want that. We didn't earn that silver medal. We're not going to take it. And so if you look at the picture of the medals, the medal stand is empty. We all jumped the first flight back, and I flew right to school and went to school the next day at Illinois State.
Not a single person on that team has ever accepted the medal.
In 2012, we had our 40th reunion, and we all got together down in Kentucky.
And the entire team was still around?
Yes, and it's the first time we've been in the same room together since that night. It's interesting, we all, to a man, said, "We will take the gold medal if they want to give a duplicate gold."
But you don't want the silver?
Under one circumstance, that you say we won the game.
Well, your biggest heartbreak was not, you know, anywhere close to the most terrible thing that happened.
Oh, my gosh. I mean,
those games.
David, we were getting ready to play in the medal round. So it was down to 4 teams, and we were getting ready to play Italy in the semis. The Olympic Village, you had a place where you could walk probably about, maybe a half mile within the village, and it's where all the food was. Mm. And so we were walking, and we stopped, and an area was roped off, and we looked, and the terrorists were on the balcony with machine guns and their ski masks. And we looked at like, what in the world is going on? So we turned and left and went. We went to practice. We came back. There were armored tanks around the village. A helicopter came in, landed right there, whisked them away. The Israeli athletes were killed, you know, at the airport. And the terrorists were all killed and stuff. So, you know, there was just, are the games going to go on?
Yeah.
You know, are they going to stop them, or what are they going to do? And I think everybody got together and said, look, you know, we don't want an act of terrorism to take away. I remember going to the memorial and paying our respects to the Israeli athletes. And then we beat Italy. And then we were on that collision course to play the Soviet Union.
You're drafted number one in 1973. And it's always seemed curious to me, whether it's football or basketball, you know, it's the worst team the previous year gets the number one pick.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you're the best player in the country, you get picked number one, but you go, you joined a team that was 9-73.
The worst team in the history of professional sports.
Well, that's always nice.
Now, I'll give you a little sidebar on this, too. So, you know, I played at Illinois State, which is about 120 miles from Chicago. Back then, when you got drafted, you got a phone call. There was no 4 days in New York City, and you're going to go around, and you get fit for suits, and you're doing all these different things. I mean, you got a phone call. Went to Philly. I just got married, found out my wife was pregnant. I broke my foot in a summer league playing. So here I am in Philly, broken foot, first peek in the draft, and my wife is pregnant with Chris.
Plus, you're in Philly, and they've gone 9-73. And that's a tough crowd.
And not only that, but, you know, it's like I'm a bust. Here I am. So I missed all of training camp. They took the cast off my foot 2 days before first game. It was still broken, but I said, I'm going to play. And so I played 25 games on my foot that was still broken until I finally broke it all the way through. And I remember that whole winter, you know, I had surgery, the bone from my hip and put it down in my foot. I was in a cast for like 4 months. And all I just had to hear that they, you know, another bust. Philly got another bust. I said, just wait, you know, just give me a chance and stuff. So Chris was born that April. I got out of the cast, and I went on a mission, man. I was working out 2-3 times a day, and I came back and eventually made 4 all-star teams. But, you know, my body broke down. I never gave it a chance. David, I was always afraid of losing my job.
4 all-star games. You averaged 18 points a game.
Yes.
And 8 seasons?
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, David, I probably should have played 15 years in the NBA. And I said, you know, I played in Philly, and I gave him my body. I gave him everything I had.
Was there a moment you thought, well, I got nothing left here?
It was hard, man, because, you know, my career was taken away from me when I was in my prime. And now all of a sudden, we're good. I mean, we're one of the best teams in the NBA. We got a chance to win a championship, and now I can't play.
Yeah.
And it was another bit of that heartache. You said that heartache about what are you going to do? And, man, I had 2 children. I had Chris, who was born. I had my little daughter, Kelly, who was young. I'm 31 years old. What am I going to do? I tell you how things work out, David. You always say, what happens? So they asked me if I wanted to do the radio, the Sixers radio for the games. I said, sure, I would love to. So I was doing their home radio. And I'd done about the first 15, 20 games, maybe. Chuck Daly was the assistant coach. So Chuck Daly left to go to Cleveland to be the head coach. Matt Gukas was doing television. So they took Matt Gukas, and he became Billy Cunningham's assistant. And I started doing TV. And that's how I got into television.
It's odd, because I was forced into the booth early as well. But it was largely because I was sucking so much that I was depleting the Earth's atmosphere.
Well, let me ask you, I have a question, you know, then for you. I mean, were you ready to give it up?
I didn't think so until they told me how much they were going to pay me.
I mean, obviously, you grew up loving this game.
Yes.
Played it because of the hours you went out from the moment you got up till there was dark, and I'm sure you had the headlights on the car or something and chipping and putting or whatever. And for it to go away young.
Oh, I didn't finish high school. That's how much I wanted to play.
As much as you want to make light of it, there still had to be some pain that this
thing
there
was.
That you loved.
There was, but, you know, I don't miss it. I'm kind of like yourself, I suspect, in that I'm still in the game.
Yes.
You know, I get to be with the best players in the world. You know, I never miss the cut. Yeah, and I'm still right at the cutting edge, you know. So I don't miss it in that sense.
Yes,
you know, and I'm still the same, around
yeah, it. I'm the same way because I realized physically I couldn't do it. And so I guess the thing I've been blessed about, David, is like I'm not a lifetime coach. I'm a lifetime basketball guy. But what I've done is I've interspersed in, I've broadcast, and then I've coached. And then I broadcast, and I've coached. So there's always been a change for me. It's not like I've had 25 straight years of coaching. And I think that always helped me because coach in Chicago, I was out of it for 7 years, broadcasting. Then I went to Detroit, did it for 3, went back to broadcasting. Then I went to Washington. And so it was always a break. So I always felt like when I went back into it, there was a freshness that I brought to it that I hadn't just been grinding the whole time.
from what I've read, it seems to me that you might have lit Michael Jordan. Phil Jackson might have smoked him, but you got him started.
Well, I feel very good about my time with Chicago. Young coach, coming into a team that had won 30 games. Nobody knew how good Michael Jordan was. I mean, Dave, they could talk about all they want to talk about. Nobody knew how good he was. And to watch Michael explode, but more importantly, to watch the Bulls franchise start moving towards a championship. And I've always said, I've always felt Michael's shot against Cleveland was the defining moment in the Bulls championship run, that Michael hit that shot. And then we went to New York and we beat New York, and went to Detroit and took them to 6 games. And to me, that was the seed that they can do it. I think Michael respected my competitiveness, and I think Michael respected the fact that I wasn't afraid to coach him. And I always tell coaches today, your best players want to be coached, and they want to be coached well, and they want to be coached hard.
And you coached him at the beginning, and you coached for him at the end, too.
Yes.
At the end of his career, he was 40 years old.
Yes. Whatever,
there was something special about him that set him apart from every other player. What was it?
Well, I will tell you this. At age 40, he was the only guy on my team to play all 82 games. He played every night. And I know he didn't feel like it. And I remember talking with him one night, because Michael and I had a different relationship then, because he was at Washington, he was the president, he was part owner, and he hired me to come in to coach the team because I think he knew that one of the things I really did well was take teams that weren't very good and build them.
You turned them around.
So when I went in there, our relationship was so different than what it was with 25. I mean, we were locking arms and meeting in rooms and doing all different kinds of things to try to build our team. The one story that is Michael Jordan, that if anybody could ever have had the moment that I had with him, was we played the Indiana Pacers on the road, and we were down about 25 at the end of the third quarter. And I just said to Michael, I said, Michael, I'm going to take you out. If we make a run, I'll put you back in. But if not, I'm not going to play you in a blowout. I didn't put him back in. They beat the heck out of us. It broke a streak of 866 straight games of him scoring in double figures. I did not know that.
866.
866 straight games he had scored in double figures. So now the media is on me. Like, what do you think Michael's going to think? Whatever, you broke his streak. And I said, you know, I think Michael and I are past that. I said, but, you know, 6 world championships, gold medals.
Is this before you've spoken to Michael?
Yeah.
So I
haven't even spoken to Michael.
She said.
I'm sure, like, let's get his story, and then let's go get his, and we'll whatever. So that lonely seat on the bus, David, front right corner that you're sitting in with all the players go by and they're mumbling under their breath, you know. Michael got on and he said, scoot over. And so I scooted over and he looked at me and he said, do you think I can still play? I said, absolutely. That's why I'm here, Michael, to help you, to do something special and to build this for you. And he said, you know, to be my coach, we got to trust each other. I got to trust you and you got to trust me, right? I said, I trust you, Michael. I said, I hope you trust me. He said, I trust you. You did the right thing. We fly back to Washington. We're staying in the same place. We get back about 3:30 in the morning. At 8 o'clock, my wife goes down to do one of her aerobics classes or whatever. She comes back and she goes, Michael's down in the gym with his trainer lifting weights like a wild man, it's soaking wet with sweat. So we play the next night. We play New Jersey. They're good. They're back-to-back NBA finals. Michael scores the first 6 points of the game. Byron Scott takes a timeout. Michael says to me, give me the ball right there the rest of the game, and don't take me out until I tell you. I said, that's fine. That's good. So about 2 minutes to go in the game, he looks at me, gives me one of these, like, I've had enough. Take him out. We're up 20. And I looked at Michael, I said, Michael, what happened? And he said, the guy guarding me told me his back was hurting. Don't ever give me an edge. Don't ever do that. He said, because I'll cut your heart out. 50 points later, at 50.
50.
50 at the age of 40. The next game he came back with 45. And so he said, I told you I could still play. And I said, I knew that.
We know Michael loves golf. What could he impart to our Ryder Cup team that would help?
Michael's big thing was like, hey, man, we're the best players. I mean, just go out and beat the guy you're playing against. Just play the way you can play and everything will work out because we got the best team. That's what I told the Olympic team in 2008. I said, you know what? There's two things that we have to do to win the gold medal. We have the best players and we have the best coach. So there's two things we have to do. The game has to be as important to us as it is to them, and we have to respect the opponent that we're playing. And if you do that, you're not going to lose. Because we have the best team, we have the best coaches, we have the best players.
Well, Coach, we've now reached the segment of the show, Rapid Fire, which personally I think is pointless, but we'll take a shot at it anyway. Start the clock, please. Better sports term, layup or gimme?
Gimme.
Better sound, swish of a net or the ball in the bottom of the cup?
Swish of the net.
Boxers or briefs?
Briefs.
Better watch an NBA playoff game or the Final Four thriller?
Final Four thriller.
83 Sixers versus the 15-16 Golden State Warriors. Who wins?
Warriors.
Your son Chris and you, one-on-one, who wins?
Me.
More effective coaching, curse word, or mayonnaise or mustard?
Extra mayo.
Extra?
Extra.
Favorite thing ever said to you by a fan?
I love you.
I love you too. You coach one of them, so you may be biased, but all-time greatest athlete?
Michael Jordan.
Hole-in-one or buzzer beater?
Hole-in-one.
Your hero growing up?
Pistol Pete Maravich.
Salty or sweet?
Salty.
Fast car or a slow boat?
This is probably going to fool you. Probably slow boat.
Slow boat?
Yeah.
One athlete you would pay to see?
Jordan Spieth.
One athlete you would pay to see naked?
David Faraday.
Oh. I'll tell you what, that'll be cheap. Well, in 1968, you really weren't a blip on the basketball radar.
No.
And 4 years later, you're playing in the Olympics. How
yes.
does that happen?
I lived in a very small town, Benton, Illinois, town of 6,000 people. I had a great high school coach, and, you know, I grew up wanting to be a Benton Ranger. We were the Rangers. My junior year, I was 6 feet tall and weighed 130 pounds. I did not start on my high school team. And then that summer, I really took off.
You were 6 feet tall and 130 pounds?
I was, my junior year in high school. A gust of wind would have blown me away kind of thing. But I was going to make it. You know, David, I knew how I was going to do it. Well, that summer, I grew, you know, about 3 inches, gained like 25 pounds. So my senior year, I was 6'3", 155, averaged 27 or 28 a game my senior year.
So you improved kind of rapidly?
I did. I got the first full-ride scholarship to Illinois State University. After my freshman year, the athletic director there, Milt Weisbecker, hired the first black coach in Division I basketball from Detroit.
Will Robinson?
Will Robinson from Pershing High School.
Huge part of your life.
Oh, man. You know, the one thing I always say, I'm a product of great men and teachers. He was about toughness and competitiveness. You know, David, I had to at Illinois State every day that we practiced, 4 chairs around the gym. We'd run 50 laps around the gym. We had to climb a rope to the top of the gym, touch the top of the gym, and then I had a box every day for 3 minutes. And I remember I asked my coach, I said, you know, just tell me why I'm doing this. He said, if you want to be great, you got to have stamina. That's why you got to run. If you want to be great, you got to have arm strength and courage. That's why you got to be able to have strong enough to climb that rope. And I want to know if you have the courage to get up there to the top of that gym. And he said, and if you're going to be good, you got to learn how to fight. Because at some point in time, somebody's going to try to rip in and take your heart. And when they do, they take your game. And he said, so don't ever walk away from that. Rolled up my sleeves, David. And 72, I made the Olympic team. And then 1973 became the first pick in the draft. This was a kid in 1968 who couldn't play for his high school team.
How much of that was Will Robinson? And what was
huge.
It like for him back then, you know, in a town with virtually no black people?
He was incredible, man. He and then just what he taught me. And I love that guy, man. David, he was a great athlete. He was a great golfer. When he played for the state championship, they would not let him play against the white kids.
Really?
And he had to play by himself. They followed him to make sure he didn't cheat. He lost by one. And he always looked at me and said, if I could have looked in that kid's eye, he said he could have never beat me. Everything with him was a lesson. And I carry everything with me. Every one of his lessons I carry with me every single day. And the day that he died, it was an amazing day where I was in broadcasting a game and he was working for the Pistons and he'd gotten really sick. And I went up to see him and he said, Champ, we were a pretty good team, weren't we? And I said, Coach, no, we were a great team. And he died the next day. I've been around amazing men And I think, David, that's why I love coaches.
Well, now, your son, Chris, he played college basketball at Duke, right? And
yes.
Then professionally for a year in Europe and then came back to be an assistant coach at Duke. And now he's at Northwestern.
Now he's at Northwestern, yes.
Yeah, not a basketball school, you wouldn't think, but
well, you know
he's
what?
Getting there.
I'm really proud of him. You know, Chris had a lot of opportunities. He could have gone to a lot of different places, but he wanted to be a school like Duke that was great academically. He wanted to be able to recruit the kind of players that he wanted to be able to coach and for the most part have for 4 years. And he wanted to do something and blaze a trail.
Oh.
We're actually going to make a substitution because if we're going to do a golf show, you have to have the best golfer in the family here. So we're going to sub the old man out.
Fair enough.
We're going to bring in the best
sort of
golfer.
Sort of the story of my life.
I take it you must be Chris?
Yes.
Sort of the story of my life, David.
There you go.
Get out of the way.
Yeah. You're really.
So,
come on.
All right.
He's out. I'm in.
So your dad says there's not much of you in him. I suspect that he may be selling himself a little short.
Yeah, I mean, I think our competitive drive, you know, I get that from him. You know, I always talk about it a lot when I was a kid. He never let me win in anything. I think it built an amazing competitive spirit in me. If we were playing horse in the backyard or one-on-one or board games or whatever it was, like it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to let him win. Like, I'm going to bury you. And
yeah.
There were so many times I would run to my room crying and I wanted to win. But it was the grand plan of like he wanted me to realize when you do win, you've earned it. And you deserve to win, and you shouldn't be given anything. And I'm so appreciative of him bringing me up that way because it built such a competitive spirit in me in such a young age.
And you got to watch so many great teams, so many great players. What was it like being a ball boy for those guys?
It was amazing. I mean, I was like a sponge. You know, I was tagging along with my dad ever since he was a player and I was a kid. And then my formative years when he was here coaching in Chicago, and I got a chance to be around Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and that group as they were evolving, and just being around a guy like Jordan and seeing the way he approached what he did, it was amazing. Forget about the games. I was in awe of the way he trained, the way he practiced, his passion every day when nobody was watching. It was a practice in a closed gym. He approached those days just like he would playing in a big game, and that really made a huge impact on me as a kid.
You're out.
I might be subbed out again.
Time out.
It looks like it. Yeah.
Last 8 minutes. Thank you. Bringing in the reliever.
Great to meet you.
Thanks for
big
fan.
Bringing in the reliever.
Yeah. Like his pop, Chris got to experience the Olympics, albeit in a totally different way. He was part of Coach K's staff in 2008 when the Redeem team brought the United States back to hoop prominence in Beijing, setting in motion a turn of events that led to one of the most memorable evenings in Doug's 60-plus years.
My son was actually one of the floor coaches because he was with Coach K at Duke, and he was one of the scouts. So coaches don't get gold medals. So Jerry Colangelo had gold medals made up for all the coaches. So in 2009, I went into the Basketball Hall of Fame, into the broadcasting wing of the Basketball Hall of Fame. And afterwards over, there's about 20 of my family and friends and all. We had a little get together afterwards. Chris was fidgeting, and there was something going on. I don't know what it was. He was sitting around, and he was fidgeting around. And so his wife, Kimmy, hit the glass or whatever and said, Chris wants to say something. So Chris got up and these tears started pouring down his cheeks. And I looked at him and I said, what's wrong, Chris? And he said, Dad, he said, 37 years too late, but you finally have your gold medal. And he reached in his pocket and he put his gold medal around my neck. And so on this particular night, I got a gold medal and I went into the Hall of Fame.
You're getting to me. I promised I wouldn't do this.
Love me back, David. The game loved me back.
And you've got grandkids, 5 of them.
Yes.
Give us a scouting report.
A lot of people don't know this, and I'll share it with you or whatever, but I don't think anybody would ever thought that I would ever had a tattoo in my life or whatever, because you're just...
And you have ink?
I have my 5 grandkids tattooed over my heart. They're the love of my life.
How cool is that?
Yeah. In fact, I'll show you.
You don't have to. Oh, yes, you do, don't you? Yeah. Cooper, Colin, and Riley. So is it Colin Collins?
It's Colin Romantic.
Okay,
but
well, that's
Colin
fortunate.
Colin is Collins without the S, so it's my daughter game. It's C-O-L-L-I-N, so she dropped the S.
Right, okay.
And it's Cooper Douglas, so we got all the Dougs covered and stuff, so.
You know, of course, that if you get enough grandchildren, you're going to be going down to
I think I'm done. I think they both had enough. And I tell you, Dave, the way I spoil these grandkids, I don't know if they would want to bring another one around, because when they're with me, there is no thing as no. I mean, it's like they know Pops will give them whatever they want.
Yeah. So you watch your grandchildren playing, obviously, and Cooper plays golf?
Cooper grew up, and he loved to have my daughter put the Golf Channel on TV. He was like 1 year old. He had plastic golf clubs and the wiffle balls, little balls. And he would look in the TV, and when they were giving, he would mimic the swings. Charles Barkley had the show with Hank Haney.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
The show was up. And so little Cooper was standing there, and he was watching Barkley, and Barkley swung, and he goes, oh, no, like, not like that. It was one of the funniest things. I told Charles Barkley.
You tell Charles?
Oh, absolutely. He goes, oh, no, Papa, not like that kind of thing.
Oh, poor
so,
Charles.
I mean, he grew up watching the Golf Channel and loved it. He would be mesmerized watching this and just emulating the guy's swing. It was so fun to watch.
You ever like to take a stab at being an analyst in golf?
You know what? I would.
It's not that hard.
You know what? I would. The thing about it is, I would I have any credibility? You know, that's the problem.
Oh, we have plenty of them that don't have that.
You know, but I mean, my buddies are out there. I mean, Roger Maltby and Peter and, you know.
Maltby, he's beautiful. I'm actually a little upset because Maltby has applied for and is going to receive, apparently, a personal blimp.
How about Roger? How much mileage he puts out on that golf course out there walking around following those guys?
I know. I'm hoping not to have to do the same.
Well, you've established, I think you're pretty good, Dave. I don't think you have to do that anymore.
What question would you like to be asked that you've never been asked?
Everybody always asked me if I would write a book.
Oh, yeah.
And I said I couldn't write a book because the only thing that sells now is dirt, and I would never do that. The people are too important to me.
And
but I have
could.
The title.
You could.
I have the title. Always a winner, but never a champion.
I'm not sure that a Hall of Famer could get away with that. I think you're a champion to a lot of people, Coach.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Thank you so
for
much.
For being here
Thank
with
you.
Me today.
Thank you. It's been an honor. I loved your show, man.
I loved it.
Doug Collins, what an amazing guy. He's dedicated his entire life to the game he loves, and I'm happy he dedicated a few hours to tell me about it. It's one of the things I love most about doing this show. Just when you think you've heard it all, you hear a new take on life that you haven't before. Doug provided several of those with a flair and energy all of his own. And it's easy to see why he's been one of the most respected men in the game for the better part of the last five decades. And as always, my brain full of magnificence is on full display at Fehertwit, for better or for worse. Thank you all for coming. Peace out, cable television world. I can't believe I said that. Good night, sweetie.